From the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors, I'm Robert Caceres, and this is The Reframe. My guest today is Dr. Mark Young. Dr. Young is Professor Emeritus of Counselor Education at the University of Central Florida and the co-founder of the UCF Marriage and Family Research Center. He's a charter member of IMFC and a nationally recognized expert and leader in the field of marriage and family counseling. Dr. Young has over 20 years of clinical experience, and he spoke with me about the important role that humility played in his professional development.
My supervisor always said I was the worst supervisee he ever had because I could never be wrong. I always had a rationale for why my approach was right, even if it was dead wrong, you know? So I had to learn that humility, the humility to be supervised. If your cup is already full, nobody can pour anything into it, right? But my self-esteem was so low because counseling is a total assault on your self-esteem because for 1 week, you'll see something in therapy you've never seen before. So getting over the myth of omnipotence and recognizing it's a constant learning process. I think Laura Pearl said, there's no therapist except a growing therapist because you're encountering situations that are brand new every day.
Welcome to The Reframe. Over the next hour, you'll hear Dr. Young discuss the common challenges and setbacks associated with couples counseling, highlight strategies for effectively working with high-conflict couples, describe his approaches to using humor and taking risks with clients, and share about his vision and hopes for the future of marriage and family counseling. Dr. Young also describes the early struggles and missteps he encountered as a novice counselor.
My real problem was that I was desperate to make something happen, and so I would be highly confrontive, and that backfired a few times. Like, I told a client one time he was boring. I wanted something to happen, and I took too much responsibility for that. I thought there was some kind of magic potion. There was a silver bullet that would cure everything, you know. As soon as I got over that and realized that the ball is in the client's court, they have to want something from me, that I stop that obsessive pressure to make something happen.
Mark began our conversation by discussing how his early work in community mental health led him to feeling ineffective and ill-equipped to work with couples.
Well, I think I was more pushed and shoved into couples counseling rather than something that I really chose. I worked in community mental health for about 9 years. And I think it's the experiences I had to see couples. I was thinking this morning about a couple that I had that she was having an affair, and the next couple I saw was the couple that the man that she was having an affair with was in there, and they were in the waiting room when I came back down with the original couple. Yeah, so I think feeling ineffective with couples is what pushed me into wanting to try to solve the mystery.
When you look back on that time of initially working with couples, what were some of those approaches that maybe you were attempting to implement that were just falling flat?
Well, I mentioned one in my IMFC keynote, as we talked about that. I felt that, I guess it's partially based on some of the early work by the behaviorists. You know, there's an actual article in which the behaviorist suggests that the couple do a quid pro quo type of compromise. In this case, and this is really sexist, but this was the actual case. In the case, he got more sex than she got French provincial furniture. It's like, that was the compromise that they worked out. But recently we've realized that quid pro quo doesn't work. If one person is keeping count, what is that really doing? So, for example, we have the surprise task in couples counseling. And I like the surprise task as a first session task. And the tasks illustrates an important point, I think, about quid pro quo. You ask the couple to each change something in their behavior without telling the other member what it is, and that we'll get back together next week and talk about what it is that you notice that the other person changed. Well, almost without fail, they can't guess what the person changed. Well, you put away the dishes every night before you went to bed. No, I always do that. Suddenly, they're paying attention to the good things that the person is doing rather than focusing on the negative. I mean, that's a huge problem in mental health anyway, is focusing on the one thing we don't have and the 99 thing instead of the 99 things we do have. So it gets the couple focused on that. And secondly, it promotes the idea that people can change, that they can change something. And then they explain what they did change. Oh, I guess that's right. I didn't notice that. You know, I'm not looking for things that you're doing right. I'm looking for things that you're not doing well. And so I think that quid pro quo kind of concept where you do this and I do that, it's your turn to change the baby's diapers. In a relationship where you're not thinking like that, where you're not thinking about whose turn is it, you're looking at a longer horizon. You know, eventually it's all going to even out. It's not going to be 50-50 all the time. It's kind of like 100%, 100%. You have to be all in. You can't be watching every move that the other person makes or doesn't make. And so the best relationships, it turns out, are not focused on quid pro quo.
You referenced the keynote that you gave last year at IMFC's conference. And in that, you mentioned that another one of those characteristics of kind of bad couples counseling is that there are definitely portions of it that look just like individual counseling with each partner in the room.
Right.
When a couple comes in, say, like with the first illustration that you gave, where there's infidelity or there's a high level of distress or trauma, how can a counselor navigate that so that it doesn't look like individual counseling or just trying to put out those fires for each person and really bringing the couple together?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are two phases of couples counseling. One is an emergency phase, and then there's the ongoing maintenance type of phase. In the emergency phase, you may have to do something like individual counseling to help that person move on. You know, if we're going to work in couples counseling, you're going to have to end this relationship, or you're going to have to be able to set aside for a little while your anger and hurt. So let's talk about it in an individual session, but always bringing the couple back together. That's an emergency phase because there's some bad things that couples can do, like, say, with infidelity, which is the TNT of relationship problems, I guess. It can blow up at any moment. In one of my books, I mentioned the fact that my sister-in-law bought this bed, headboard for a bed, and it had two bullet holes in it. Yeah. And that's how dangerous infidelity can be. So anything that blows up the relationship, the discovery that the other person has maxed out all the credit cards or whatever it is, there's an emergency phase where each couple, member of the couple, has to recognize that the other person has some changing to do.
Could you talk a bit more about how in that emergency phase, you kind of cultivate that buy-in from each partner of taking kind of that leap of faith or instilling them a sense of hope when maybe it feels like there's no faith to have?
Yeah. And I this is a big theme in our book, Counseling and Therapy for Couples, that hope is essential. You have to give them hope. They don't have hope. If you think about what people have to go through before they get to counseling, you know, they've tried everything else. So if you don't give them hope in the first session, they feel like they've just given you a laundry list of all the problems they've told everybody else, and they haven't really come. It's like if you went to the doctor and they gave you a bunch of tests, but they never told you the results. And that's, you know, how that actually happens. You go to the doctor, you get a bunch of tests. No one's ever asked you, well, why are you here to see the doctor? That does happen. And the same thing occurs in couples counseling. People come in and you listen, but you also need to, at the end of the session, they need to hear along the way that, you know, I think there is hope for this. I think we can do something about this. It's not going to be easy, but together, I think we can make some progress. So yeah, if they don't have hope, you have to lend them some of yours.
I just think about maybe novice couples counselors or students who are kind of navigating that for the first time or really struggling with that, and maybe they themselves don't necessarily have hope for that relationship. How might a person convey that genuinely, that installation of hope in a way that's fair?
I guess fake it till you make it. I really would. I would, even if there is hope, you have to believe that there's hope, I think, as a counselor. If you don't believe that there's hope for this person, that people can really change, then, you know, it's a very difficult job, I think. So I think you do have to have that general sense of hope with clients. But I think you could identify certain things about the relationship that are good. You could focus on that and say, you know, there was a time in this relationship when the two of you were doing well. And I think there's hope that we can return to that.
I can't help but think about my own experience. I just tend naturally to be a very optimistic, hopeful person. Sometimes from clients, I've been criticized for that. I've been called like a Pollyanna or Little Susie Sunshine for trying to illustrate or kind of shine a light on some of the things that you're highlighting as a necessity of moving forward. Have you had similar pushback in your efforts to instill hope in your clients?
No, I haven't. But, you know, my nickname as a supervisor was Simon because I would give my supervisees the naked truth. But, and I think that I have some of that reputation with clients too. They know that I'm being serious. I don't lay it on too thick. You know, I once supervised this counselor and he had to leave and he went to another agency in a different state. And I got his clients and I said, Ed was really a nice guy, you know, and they would say, yes, but you know what? I didn't feel I could tell him the bad stuff. I think I withheld that. They all said this because I didn't want him to be disappointed. So that's the line you have to make sure you're not crossing, that you're available. Like in the emergency room and the doctor sees a broken arm, you don't want him to go, oh, that's terrible. You want him to say, oh, I can fix that. And here's what we did. That's the kind of attitude that needs to be conveyed somehow without being negative, providing hope, but without being Pollyanna, like you said.
Could you maybe, reflecting on your career, chart like your progression development of how you were able to very much integrate a style that's true to your personality and yet conform that to kind of what's necessary to be an effective couples counselor? How has that evolved?
Oh, I think it was through supervision. And I think that's a crucial aspect. You know, it takes probably 7 to 10 years to learn how to do couples counseling. That's very discouraging to people who hear that. But you stumble around, and unless you have good supervision, my colleague Mike Robinson said one time, that 1 year you had of experience, that 15 years you had of experience was the same year over and over again. So unless you have supervision, you're not really changing and growing in your abilities. So it was through that supervision that I received. And one of the supervisors said to me, you know, you need to have fun in the counseling session. And, you know, I never thought of that because I was focused on the clients. But he said, if you're having fun, the client's having fun. And so I tried to amuse myself. I tried to make sure I was really being myself because, you know, I do think life is funny and I have a philosophical sense of humor that I inject in my relationships and in therapy too. I learned to be myself by attaching to humor, first of all, but also to really focusing on what I wanted to talk about in the session too, not just listening to the client because they need to hear something from me too. That's different than individual counseling. And one of the ways it's different is that you don't have the same kind of relationship with two people as you have with one. That's group therapy. You know, two is the smallest group. So it's group therapy. You have to have people interact with each other and with you. And so you have, you know, six different relationships going on, whereas it's a one-to-one relationship in individual counseling.
Did your sense of humor or your unique approach ever get you into trouble? Because I think about, you can almost gauge how humor or a joke might land with a single person, but it's kind of a roll of the dice to have it land with two or more people.
Well, I don't remember it having my humor having a negative impact. I do remember, but see, early on, my real problem was that I was desperate to make something happen. And so I would be highly confrontive. And that backfired a few times. Like I told a client one time he was boring. Yeah, and I was highly confronted with an addicted client, a heroin addict, one time, and she just flipped out. And, you know, I wanted something to happen. And I took too much responsibility for that. I thought there was some kind of magic potion. There was a silver bullet that would cure everything, you know. And as soon as I got over that and realized that the ball is in the client's court, they have to want something from me. That I stopped that obsessive pressure to make something happen.
What was the impetus for you getting over that? I know as a supervisor myself, and then just as someone who does part-time couples and family counseling, like that can be an ever-present mindset of like, oh, you know, like I have a huge responsibility. I need to make something happen. What was, you know, kind of the starting point for you saying like, oh, this isn't my responsibility. I need to work through this.
I think it was understanding that I needed to go back to basics. And it happened with a particular client. He was a 16-year-old boy and he had obsessive compulsive disorder. And I had been practicing for that point about 8 years, maybe. And I considered seeing him alone. He tightened every shampoo bottle in the house before he could go to bed, that kind of thing. But I decided to see the family. And I saw the whole family together. And I just let it happen. I facilitated. I got everybody to express what they were feeling. And somehow things started getting better. I was so surprised because it was really the first success I'd ever had in family therapy that I realized it was creating the relationship with the family. They loved me. I loved them, you know, that created the change. And so that's what I learned to rely on, is making sure that foundation is there before I tried anything fancy. And that success led to confidence that I could help other people. And I think you don't have that confidence when you're first starting out. You have to have those successes.
Going forward, experiencing that initial confidence, were there ever periods where you felt like you were plateauing or that confidence waned and you had to kind of make a concerted effort to regain that sense of stability and almost like your clinical swagger?
I remember plenty of failures, and I think I learned from my failures more than my successes, really. I don't remember plateauing as much as, because when a couple plateaus, in our model, what we do is we give them the power to develop a maintenance plan for themselves. And then we think of it as a family doctor model. They can come back for a refresher course, but the door is always open, kind of. But the couples, you validate the changes that the couple has made because they don't see it all the time. And then you let them take over. So that's the plateau. When things start to plateau, you may be at a place where they need to go out on their own and try and exist without you, because they can become dependent on the relationship instead of dealing with each other. But I remember plenty of failures. And I think I learned, as I said, I learned more from those than anything else.
I was just watching a behind the scenes documentary on Alabama football yesterday, and Nick Saban was reflecting on his brutal loss to Clemson last year in the national championship. And he said, you know, that was a massive failure. And in my career, I never let a failure go to waste. And so it does seem like those failures for you were incredibly instructive. Are there a couple in particular that you look back on as just, you know, monumental moments in your career that you just took something massive away from?
Yes. One of them was, he was a surgeon and she was a bikini model. That's how they met. So, you know, that wasn't good to start with. Their whole relationship was based on how she looked in a bathing suit. And she was a crying Baptist. And when I say crying, I mean, she cried in every session. And she couldn't articulate, and he was a very intelligent guy. And they had two special needs children. So you can imagine what that was like. They couldn't relate at an intellectual level. He thought she was stupid. And she wasn't stupid. She was of average intelligence. She was perfectly fine. But that relationship was unbalanced from the very start. And I couldn't manage the emotional intensity of the sessions to keep her in the room. She would run screaming and crying from the room. So if you can't stay in the session, that's not a, that doesn't help counseling, right? So I learned from that to manage emotional intensity. Do not let it get out of hand. Sometimes in individual sessions, we want to intensify the emotion, have the person experience the reality of the emotions that they're really experiencing. I didn't know I felt that. But in couples counseling, we have to manage it so that it doesn't spill over into the other person, because one negative, as Gottman says, it has to be repaired. There's a powerful, negative emotions are so much more powerful than positive, and negative things that you say to your partner are so much more powerful than the positive. It's a sad truth, but something we have to learn. So we don't let couples get out of hand. We don't let them fight during the session, for example. That's what I learned. Have you ever seen Insoo Kim Berg work? One of the things that she says, she'll say to couples is, and I think I mentioned this in my talk, I'm not sure. She said, if the couple starts to talk about, and then one day he, okay, we'll get back to that, she says. But then she never does. She's actually shutting down storytelling, and because the client, it's the game in transactional analysis would be judge and jury. You know, you're the judge, and each one of them is bringing their case to you, and you're supposed to act on who's right or wrong. And so you just don't allow that. Don't allow fighting. So that's what I learned from that couple. Manage emotional intensity and don't let them fight. It's a big waste of time.
Just thinking about my own experience, like that's easier said than done. How do you find yourself in those moments where it's escalating, maybe having to get creative or be incredibly directive just to make sure that that, you know, line is not crossed?
Yeah. Well, do you remember the transition you made from individual to group counseling? You have to be much more active. And this is something that you're not prepared for. You think it's just like individual session. You're going back and forth. You listen. You have to direct. You have to be much more directive. If you don't, it will get out of hand because they have secret hidden agendas that you don't know about. They've been together for longer than, and so they know how to get to the other person. And so you can't let them go there. So that being more active and being directive are two things you don't want to do as a counselor, but they're absolutely required when you go to family. You know, family therapy is a lot like taming lions. You be quiet. Now you talk. Now you talk. Now you be quiet. Sometimes it's like that. And same thing in couples counseling. You have to manage who's talking and what they're allowed to say, and to some extent, because you don't want them to recreate. Because if they leave the session feeling, you know, this is what we do at home. We argue and we don't get anywhere. So why let them do that in the counseling session? Let them leave with the feeling that something new has happened. And this, of course, you get from Virginia Satir and experiential therapies, that the client needs to experience something in the couple session that gives them hope. You remember Virginia Satir would say, would you say this by looking into her eyes, or hold her hand for a minute and tell him that, you know, what you really feel like when he says that.
That dynamic that's unique and like that demand of you to be more directive in couples counseling versus individual counseling, is that something that you review and say your informed consent that, hey, there are going to be times where I don't intend to come off as rude or curt or cut you off? That's not meant to be dismissive. That's meant just to formulate and cultivate a dynamic that's therapeutic. Because I can just anticipate if clients aren't expecting that or aware of that, that they can get incredibly offended and feel dismissed.
No, I don't think they feel dismissed. I feel like they like it that you're managing the emotional intensity. But you never let the client see the machinery behind the therapy. It's like, don't look at the man behind the curtain. Jay Haley taught me that, I guess.
Are there other instances from your career that you look back on as, you know, missteps or failures that were also instructive?
On plenty of them, but a lot of them were due to my inexperience, and I'm grateful to the clients that they taught me. I can't think of any particular couple at this moment, because later on in my career, what I did was I really focused on the psychoeducational stuff, not because I particularly wanted to, because we did a study and we found that clients who are in therapy versus clients who are in psychoeducational groups, like this is how, you know, couples education groups, this is relationship training, this is communication training, you know what I'm talking about, right? Like PAIRS and PrEP and Prepare Enrich, these programs that are devised to help couples learn basic skills. So you contrast that with therapy. And what we found out is that couples who are the most distressed don't work well in psychoeducation. They need to be an individual, you wouldn't call it individual, but conjoint couples counseling. Whereas couples who are doing pretty well seem to benefit more from. So, you know, we go back to 1967 when Paul said, what's the best treatment for this client with this particular problem under this specific set of circumstances? We have to tailor the treatment to the client.
Well, you referenced your research with couples. Could you speak about what initiated your co-founding of UCF's Marriage and Family Research Center?
Yeah, well, Andrew Dare and I, Andrew Dare is now the dean at Virginia Commonwealth. And he was my student when he was an undergraduate. So I've known him since he was 19. And so the minute he graduated from his doc, he was a master's student with me. And then when he got his doctorate at Florida State, we recruited him immediately because we knew what kind of person he was. He's extremely organized, ambitious, and empathic and total and confident. And all of those things we were looking for in terms of building a marriage and family therapy program. So we applied for a grant for $5 million and we're very surprised when we got it. But Andrew was the person who spearheaded the development of the center. I was the person who helped write the first grant. I had some recognition, and I think that might have helped. And I was a full professor at the time, so I was more like a figurehead. He was the person who really made it happen throughout the whole thing. And I think up to this point, they've got more than $27 million in grants. My portion would be around $6 million or something like that if you look at my percentages. But in reality, it was a team effort, and I was just a very small part of the team, really. I'm more of an idea person. I'm not the guy who likes to schedule the clients, make the classes happen, or do what Andrew did, which is deal with all the financials and the institutional requirements and all the things that are required when you have a big grant. But that grant is ongoing now, and Sejal Barden is the director now, and I'm completely out of it, so.
Looking back to your involvement, though, with the center, what were some of the interesting research findings that either you were surprised by or just those phenomena that you were looking to investigate that you were especially curious about?
Well, when we look at, you know, this is part of a larger national research project where they brought together, I think more than 7,000 individuals have been treated now in our program. But in all the ones together, it must be in the 30 or 40, 50,000. Clients over the years. So one of the things that's surprising is that couples work is not that powerful. I think Gottman places it at 20%, you know, the effect size. So it's not a powerful treatment. It requires all sorts of motivation on the part of the client, perseverance, and so on. So that's a surprising finding from the, but anecdotally, we know that some clients are helped immensely from the program. They, because the program gave them babysitting for the night and dinner, and these are low income couples, about more than half are Spanish speaking. And when I, you know, that includes people from Colombia, from Puerto Rico, Venezuela. Those are the main groups in Central Florida, main Spanish-speaking groups. But people in general who were quite poor. And and they had kids. So we recruited from the WIC office, from the, you know, from where they received food stamps. And these are couples who care about their kids and want to make their relationship work, but they're under enormous stresses. They maybe work two or three jobs. They're all living from paycheck to paycheck. They don't sometimes have enough money for gas to get there. So the program paid for some of those kinds of things too. And so what we found out is that there are certain people who are really, it's a group therapy experiment. Many of them started their own Facebook page with their group because it'd be like six couples. So you have 12 people and they start a Facebook group. They keep in touch afterwards. And the group process, when the group process works, it's really great. If there's one really disturbed couple in there that fights all the time, they find themselves being pushed out of the group. So there are people who work well in psychoeducational groups and there are people who don't.
Could you speak more about the other research that you've conducted and the findings that have been particularly interesting or have surprised you as well?
Well, I suppose the one finding is that the method that we developed called the integrative model of couples counseling is a brief model. And we train people to try to do couples counseling in like 6 or 8 sessions. And we gave them 40 hours of training. And that we found that that was a powerful enough treatment to consider it an evidence-based methodology. There are 3 or 4 integrative models of couples counseling, but we were happy to find that this one, which is based on the fact that the couple really needs hope. And Worthington talks a lot about, he's got a method called hope-focused counseling. He's an emeritus at Virginia Commonwealth. Hope-focused counseling, that's a big part of it. But also identifying, you know, all brief therapy models identify a focal problem, because couples will come in with 20 problems. And if they can have a success with one, this is what we found in our research, if they can decrease their conflict and divorce proneness goes down. So this brief model, so brief treatment works. That's what we found out.
You also highlighted that many other approaches and treatments have a lower success rate. And, you know, this is a dynamic that's prone to conflict or prone just to not on the counselor's end feeling like, oh, you know, this was successful because the couple made progress or they stay together. So for those out there considering couples counseling, you know, why even do it? What would your word of encouragement be to them about what's rewarding or why it's so necessary to still pursue as a professional path?
Well, when Andrew and Darren and I started the Marriage and Family Research Institute, we agreed that what we wanted to do was something for children. Sounds funny, right? But we really believed that the best intervention that we could make would be to get their parents on the same page. And that's the focus of our model. We try to get buy-in from both members of the couple. I mentioned the fact that that the Sesame Street model where you do this and I do that doesn't really work. So we try to identify something that they both want. And that if they both say, you know what, we can't communicate, that's our problem, then we focus totally on that. So when you can get buy-in from both members of the couple, that completely relieves the situation, because usually one member feels they've been dragged in. So you feel a sense of accomplishment just by providing, you know, like I said, if they only come for one session and it's a total disaster, then they say, oh, I've tried couples counseling. And, you know, so it's a serious moment when a couple comes in, but it's incredibly rewarding when one member of the couple holds out an olive branch to the other member and says, you know, I haven't done everything that I should have done and I want to make things better. And what can I do? When that moment happens and the other person responds and you start to see the couple getting better, you know that you've had an impact, not just on them, but, you know, maybe you know this from your own experience, that when a couple divorces, everybody in the families have to choose sides. not, you know, there are certainly times when couples should divorce, but if marriages can be held together, it's holding together a whole community, their extended families and their children. And that reverberates for generations, that you can just discard people in your life. That's why I think once people make the decision to divorce, divorce counseling is very important too. But I'm never focused on that. I'm always thinking, how can we make this work? Because I know what the repercussions are going to be like for everyone.
Your current status is Professor Emeritus at UCF, and I know that you're still actively writing books. From your vantage point, what do you feel like the most pressing needs or issues are that are facing marriage and family counselors presently?
Well, I think certainly from a standpoint of politics and so on, marriage and family therapists are still strapped with the problem of not being able to diagnose couples and get reimbursed. Not that they should be diagnosed, but reimbursement is spotty when you do couples counseling. So I think that's a problem. The second is, it takes such a long time to be good at it. If you see one couple a week when you're in private practice, you're probably lucky. Unless your practice is totally devoted to marriage and family therapy, all marriage and family therapy people are seeing individuals. They're not seeing couples and families entirely. So in order to collect that 10,000 hours of experience, you need to have a constant, and this is what working at the Marriage and Family Research Institute did for us and for many, for over 100 therapists that we've trained there. They've seen couple after couple after couple, and that starts to sink in after a while. You start to see the patterns. You start to know what works and what doesn't work. So I think that is a handicap, is that in most counseling sessions, including a private practice, you don't see enough couples to get good at it. That's why there's so much bad couples counseling.
Are you aware of, or would you like to promote some resources that are just out there that might be free or low cost that those who may not get that in-person experience and who are working to develop competency maybe at a slower rate than someone who is in your center can kind of avail themselves to kind of at least contextually and academically like beef up their knowledge as a form of professional development?
Yeah, I don't think reading is going to help you that much as having experience with couples. And one way to get that in a low-risk setting is to start a couples psychoeducational group. Use one of the ones that's been scientifically, has some backup, like PAIRS or PREP or Prepare Enrich. And those programs will get you some experience with couples. And you get to see, in a session, you get to see six couples. You start to see patterns. You start to be comfortable with working with couples and so on. I remember my first supervisor told me, don't even bother doing premarital counseling. They're in love. They're not going to even listen to you. But that was in the days when people got married first and then lived together. Now people have been living together for 6 or 7 years. You're not seeing many couples for premarital counseling who are religiously oriented, so they didn't have sex before marriage and they don't live together and so on. That's a rarity. And so premarital counseling is now something we can do even in a group setting. And Prepare Enrich, for example, allow, like when I would do premarital counseling before, I'd ask them, well, what kind of problems do you guys anticipate? And they'd say, well, nothing. We're, you know, everything's perfect. And that's still kind of how it is a little bit. But in Prepare Enrich, of course, you fill out all these forms and you pretty soon find out you're on a completely different page with finances or with how you're going to raise the kids. And nobody's ever talked about that before, but there it is in black and white, and you have to deal with the conflicts. So I think some of those programs, especially the better ones, will give you the experience that you need to work with couples. And then you can, I'd say that's a good place to start.
What do you think about kind of where the profession has grown and progressed since you entered, not begrudgingly, but like, as you said, your hand was forced, and now looking ahead to the future.
Well, couples counseling was always a stepchild of family therapy. And it was the same principles and even the same theories from individual counseling were the primary ones. In the first book we wrote in 1997, we were still using theories like Bowen to talk about couples. And that things have drastically changed. Now couples therapy is seen as a separate entity. If you take a look at some of the textbooks now, they have a whole chapter. They'll talk about different theories of psychotherapy, and then they have group and they have couples. There's a recognition that these are standalone kind of experiences now, and that they're not just an offshoot of the general theories.
And what would your hope be for like that next phase or that next wave of evolution of couples counseling?
Well, I think the foundation is there with licensure for marriage and family therapists. And in Florida, we have to take a couples course. I certainly would think that would be should be a national standard, that everyone should have a couples course and probably an internship working with couples. That's how I learned to do group. I had a practicum and two internships in group. And then for 2 years after that, you know, there's no substitute for having a mentor who's really good at what you want to do. It's a guild concept that you have to be an apprentice before you can be a journeyman. A journeyman is somebody who can do a day's work without supervision, but still rely on a supervisor when they need to. Then there's experts who are above that. And so you need an expert supervisor. And I think I've been lucky that way. Well, I told my mentor one time, I've been so lucky with the teachers that I've had. And he said, you look for teachers. And so having that humility and being able to apprentice yourself to someone. And, you know, one of the things I did was I started a program. Well, I was co-founder of a program where we brought in family therapists from all over the country to give seminars over a 5-year period. And we had everybody. We had Murray Bowen as our first presenter. We had Steve DeShazer and Insoo Kimberg, and you name it, we had them. And I got to hang out with them. And I became especially close with James Framo, who was I asked him, what's the difference between you and Bowen? He said, about 30 pounds. So through those experiences, I got to hang out for days at a time with some of the founders of the profession. We had everybody but Mnuchin. We had Carol Hoffman. We had Peggy Papp, and so on. And so I learned from them one-on-one, I think.
If you were to recommend maybe to those students out there who are listening or novice counselors, kind of dispositional ways of seeking out that mentorship, of being persistent and of developing those relationships, what might your recommendations be?
Well, my supervisor always said I was the worst supervisee he ever had because I could never be wrong. I always had a rationale for why my approach was right, even if it was dead wrong, you know? So I think I had to learn that humility, the humility to be supervised. If your cup is already full, nobody can pour anything into it, right? So I had to learn that. But my self-esteem was so low because counseling is a total assault on your self-esteem, because every time you go to for 1 week, you'll see something in therapy you've never seen before. We had a sister and brother who came in, and they were a couple. I mean, they were a couple. And one of my supervisees said, well, what do you do with a situation like this? I said, I have no idea. I never saw anything like this before. And that's, so you're constantly facing situations. And so if your self-esteem is built on, I have to know everything. So getting over the myth of omnipotence and recognizing it's a constant learning process. If you're not growing, you know, I think Laura Pearl said, there's no therapist except a growing therapist. Because you're encountering situations that are brand new every day.
I'd like to ask you for a moment just to reflect on your time with and involvement with IMFC and kind of what that organization meant to you and what potentially it could mean for those out there considering joining IMFC.
Well, I was a founding member. It really started, and it had the funniest logo because it was just a thrown together kind of organization at the time. And I was the director of the Family Therapy Institute at Ohio University at the time as a doctoral student. And that's when I joined. And so my involvement has been to go to conferences, present at conferences. Let's see, have I ever been an officer? No, I don't think I've ever been an officer. I always considered myself to be like someone who was learning at IMFC institutes. And I particularly remember seeing James Framo, and this video is still available if you ever get a chance to see it, that IMFC did a whole series at the ACA conferences. It was an attempt to mimic other conferences where master therapists would present a case. And so there are several of these, but I think they're quite old. I'd like to see that come back. I'd like to see live demonstration. It's harder now for ethical reasons. In fact, this couple really didn't know they were going to be recorded in or seen in front of a live audience. They had to manage that at the thing. John Carlson put that together, you know. So I would like to see IMFC do that kind of thing. What have I gained from IMFC? I read the journal and try to stay on top of what's going on. And surprisingly, many of my students are in that journal. Every month, at least one student is in there. So it's heartening to see that.
Well, you've mentioned that you've had great mentorship. I'm very fortunate to have Sam Gladding as a mentor, current president of IMFC. And just thinking about generationally, the mindset and perception of what it means to be a divisional member, that maybe clinicians of his generation, that was so much of their identity and their work was rooted around like that community and that shared goal. And I feel like for younger clinicians coming up, such as myself, there might be that sense of, oh, our professors tell us that we need to be involved in ACA, perhaps, you know, have a divisional affiliation, but it may not necessarily be as deeply rooted or as much of a priority for younger clinicians. What would you say to those who don't quite have the same understanding or buy-in of the value and importance of divisional membership, of why IMFC could be a good home for them?
I think that their professional identity as counselors helps them fit into IMFC. There are other organizations, but they're a mixed bag. They contain psychiatrists, and so it's a more comfortable home. You're talking about the same kinds of basic understandings. I think that's one of the things that's good about IMFC. And the other thing is that there are a lot of great programs, not just the national conference, but at ACA. If they could somehow track those and stay in touch with those, I think that would be of immense benefit. Maybe we have to go to a clinical membership to give people the concept that they're really, that it's really something special, or a supervisor credential or something like that. I'm sure that's been tossed around, but those are just trappings, really, I think. But sometimes that's meaningful to people to really get a sense that this is where they identify.
I guess as we wrap up, I'd want to invite you again, maybe for those out there who were listening, who are, you know, really committed to the practice of couples counseling and yet find themselves floundering, or those who are like, you know, I just haven't seen enough couples yet and I'm not as good at identifying the patterns. What advice you might offer them or word of encouragement to kind of spur them on to keep fighting the good fight?
Oh, wow. Well, that's why I developed a step-by-step model for couples counseling. and the model, which is in our book. the reason I'm promoting it is because that's what I wanted. When I was a beginning couples counselor, I needed a map to figure out. And it tells you what not to do and what to do, how to focus on a single problem. And I think that's crucial, is thinking about it as brief therapy. Don't think of it as a long-term, I have to solve every problem that this couple has. They got a lot of problems. And so you focus in on one of them. And I think this is what you learn to do. And when you have those success with a small thing, the couple feels better, you feel better, and the therapy has gone somewhere. It doesn't have to be. I think the worst thing that can happen in couples counseling is that it goes on and on and on, and the couple feels they can't handle it without you.
And as we wrap up, I would just want to ask you the question that I end every interview with, and that's to think back on a time in your life where either clinically or personally, you thought about something or were behaving in a certain way that was counterproductive, and you had to step back and reframe that situation or that mindset, and you found it to be incredibly beneficial.
When I was first starting out, and I wasn't having very many successes with clients, I couldn't accept, I guess what I had to stop and recognize is I'm a beginner. That was the reframe. I assumed that my intelligence or my insight or something like that was going to be all that my clients need, or my advice. But I had to recognize that it's a journey. It's a long journey to really be good at this profession. It's not something you're done with when you get licensed. So the reframe for me was, I'm still learning. I'm still a baby in this profession, even though I've been in it for 5 years. And that helped me. And it also, I was in a class, and there was a sign on the wall. I don't remember exactly what the sign said, but it was something like this. You can't wait for other people to teach you. You have to go out and make them teach you. It's not a passive process. Those two things, the recognition that I had to make it happen and that I have to be patient with myself, those were big turning points for me.
The Reframe is a production of the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and review the show in Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. Join me next month on The Reframe.